Terry Robinson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. You're a breath of fresh air. That's a great name for your program.
Oh, thanks. Glad you liked it. What was your relationship to Mary Lou?
Well, I was hired by Mr. Mayer. Mr. Mayer would call me in to train movie stars. I worked with Gable and Tracy and most of the people at Metro. At this particular time, stars were reporting to studios as people go to factories. Studios had people on the contract. They made the movies. They put the movies out for their theaters. So they had people like myself to train, teach stars, athletic things they had to do in films. And I was called in. I was called in for Mario. They signed Mario to a contract, and he had to lose about 25 pounds for his first film. So Mr. Mayer introduced us. And Mario said he had known me because he was very interested in weightlifting and bodybuilding, and I had my pictures in the Strength and Health magazines. And he said, I'm glad to be working with you, Terry. And I said, hey, that's fine. Now, he was a good-looking, dark-haired, brown-eyed kid, and we had an affinity, a good vibration. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. He's from South Philadelphia. We sort of spoke the same language. And I started to train Mario. His wife at the time was pregnant. So I got to meet Betty. And I found them an apartment, a duplex in Beverly Hills. And, of course, I called a friend of mine, also from Philadelphia, who was Mr. America, that Mario knew, was a fellow named George Eiferman, who went to Olney High School. I guess that's North Philadelphia. And between us, we'd work out with Mario. He'd like to box, run the beach. And we moved Betty, who was pregnant, and Mario into their duplex. And as I said in my book, Betty announced, what a character troop we are. She's pregnant. George was about 220. Mario about 225. I was about 180 at the time. What the neighbors would think of this group moving in. And it was sort of funny. We all became friends. And when I heard Lanza sing, that was enough for me. I was sold. I couldn't believe that this young man with this good-looking face and this big, husky body could have such a sweet, beautiful tenor voice.
What kind of program did you create for him to trim him down?
Well, he liked to box. As I say, South Philadelphia, brought up playing ball, fighting and going to gymnasiums, and he liked to lift weights. So what we did, I corrected his diet problems. I mean, here was a chance for the boy to make his first movie. And I kept him on his grapefruits and some hard-boiled eggs or some shrimp. And I kept him basically from overeating after he ate, let's say, and never to eat late at night. We would run in the morning, we'd go back, we'd do some boxing. I had a big bag for him to punch. I had him in a sweatsuit. Then we'd do some weightlifting to open up what he called the rib cage so he would breathe and his tubes would be open for his singing. And he loved that feeling of that power. He loved to be strong and big when he sang because Mario didn't sing small. Mario sang big. And he had that feeling of power in him.
Well, what might be nice to do here is to play one of his records, perhaps one of his most famous ones, Be My Love. And after we hear it, we'll come back and talk some more about your work with Mario Lanza.
Fine.
love's promised land, there'll be no one but you for me.
That's Mari Alonso's very famous recording, Be My Love, and with me is his biographer, Terry Robinson, who also was his good friend and worked with him for many years. He was just explaining that he worked with him organizing a fitness program, getting him into shape, helping him to lose weight when that became necessary. But they also hung around a lot together and became very close, and Robinson is now the guardian of Lanza's children.
Was guardian, appointed guardian after Mari and his wife died, but I'm still with him. I have the two boys with me now, and a girl is coming in Saturday to attend the Mari Alonso Institute ball Sunday night. So I have the two boys, we're at the hotel together.
How did Lanza break into films?
That's a very interesting story. Mario got out of service, but while Mario was in service, he was in Winged Victory, and he was taken to Hollywood parties, and he always sang. Walter Pidgeon, the great actor who's now in his 80s, was at a party one night and heard Lanza sing, and he got to know Lanza. Something happened at the Hollywood Bowl. You're recently... retired orchestra leader here, Eugene Normandy, was conducting at the Hollywood Bowl, and a tenor from Italy was supposed to sing there, named Ferruccio Tagliavini. He had some temperamental problems, and he refused to sing. They were looking for a tenor. They called the head of RCA Victor on the West Coast, Art Rush, and he said, I know of a boy that's in a bel canto trio touring. If we can get him, the people will forget Tagliavini. They contacted Lanza. He did have an open day, and he flew out to California. When Walter Pidgeon heard it was the boy he knew as a soldier, he brought Louis B. Mayer, the head of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's secretary, Mrs. Koverman, to the bowl. She heard Lanza perform, and she took a look at him, and she said, Walter, I've got to introduce that young man to Mr. Mayer. The next day, Mario met Mr. Mayer. And that's how his contract came about. Mr. Mayer liked him on the spot and said, I'm going to make you a singing Clark Gable.
So how did he go about cultivating him to step into that role?
Well, here's what happened. Mr. Mayer had a record of Lanza. They brought a record, and he called all his producers and directors, all the people at the studio, music department. He played the record. And some of them sat there and said, gee, that's Caruso. That's the best we ever heard Caruso. I wonder where Mr. Mayer got the record. Mr. Mayer said, you just heard a young man, 28 years old, I signed to a contract. I want you to meet him. And he called Mario out on the stage. Then Mr. Mayer said, I want one of you out there to come up with a script. I want this boy to make a film here. He's now under contract. So Joe Pasternak, who did a lot of musicals in his time, had a thought. Knowing Mario came from Philadelphia, he brought Catherine Grayson, the opera singer, and he used Ethel Barrymore, whose family came from Philadelphia. And they came up with a picture called The Midnight Kiss. Mario would play a truck driver just out of the service. Catherine was the wealthy grandmother's grandchild. And the two fall in love and so on and so forth. From this, everyone thought Mario was a truck driver because the publicity department played that up. XGI truck driver. But Mario never drove a truck. Lanza never worked. He studied. His mother gave him the opportunity. His parents, his grandparents had a grocery store on 7th and Christian Street where he was born. And Grandpa Salvatore was the ruler of the roost. He had a bunch of kids, you know, they're still living here. And, of course, Lanza was the first grandson. When they found out he could sing, he was pampered. He just had to study.
When he became popular, I'm sure the people in South Philadelphia felt great pride in him.
Well, yes, the first time we came back here on a tour... They had an American Legion affair here with President Truman was the guest of honor. And, of course, Mario came back at the same time to open his picture called The Midnight Kiss. Catherine Grayson, at that time she was married to Johnny Johnson. The mother and father all came back. And, of course, there's a fellow singing at Palumbo's now, Al Martino. He was just a young kid running in a parade. And Al Martino tells a story when he observed this and he saw Lanza's sitting on the top of this car with all his fame. He said, I'm going to be a singer one day and do it. And he did. And the people here just loved him. I mean, he was a hero. He suddenly, out of South Philadelphia, just opened up to the world.
You tell a story in your book about how South Philly nearly turned on him because of the way he was misquoted.
That was quite sad. Mario was quite famous at this time, and a reporter, one of the movie magazines, sent a reporter out, and the three of us were in Mario's den, the reporter, Mario, myself. Now, I'm originally from Brooklyn. The reporter was from Chicago. We were all drinking, and we all started to swap underworld stories, and I told about all the tough guys in my neighborhood and the things I did when I ran numbers and telephone numbers and things, and I didn't know what I was doing. I would get a quarter for envelopes going from candy store to candy store. And, of course, Mario told stories, because Mario did have a peculiar experience in his life. When he was 9 years old, his uncle Vincent was shot down in front of the house in a gang war, and the family always had an affinity for gangs and gang wars. And, of course, the reporter was from Chicago, and he told worse stories than we told. The interesting thing was, this reporter was so drunk that I had to call his lady friend to drive him to Malibu Beach. I wouldn't let him get in his car. He probably couldn't have found this car. And the next month, 3 weeks later, when a story came out in that issue, Mario was on a cover. I'll never forget what happened. He did not quote me. He did not quote himself. He quoted my story, his story, into Lanza. And Lanza was supposedly saying that South Philadelphia was the worst place in the world. And he went on and on. Well, you don't know what happened a month after that. I had to move into Mario's house. We got threatening letters. I had to call a bomb squad. We had to notify the police department. Mario had a little child at the time. Colleen was maybe 3-4 years old when Lisa was born. And we got a big dog for the backyard. And I had to monitor all phone calls. And Mario really got frightened. Now, what we had to do, Mario then sent a telegram to a South Philadelphia paper that they published. And then the magazine retracted the story the following month. But the damage was done. A lot of people were hurt by it, and especially Mario. That was one of the turning points in Mario's life about being careful of the press. He got a terrible press. In fact, the worst article ever written in Time magazine, brutal article, was written on Lanza. They put him on a cover, and anyone that has that issue, or as I say in my book, they really tore Lanza apart, Time magazine.
What did they say about him?
Well, people that they interviewed, that he never took a shower, never took a bath, that he kept his socks on now for 6 months, Terry. You know, I mean, after all. I mean, that's what they quoted in Time. I think they were a little jealous. I think people were a little jealous of the fact that here was this kid out of South Philadelphia suddenly being so world famous, it was unbelievable, and being able to sing every type of music. You know, he not only sang opera. You just heard his popular song. Well, he sang religious. He's got a gold album for religious. He's got a gold album for semi-classical, the student prince. He's got a gold. He's the only vocalist that has a gold album for opera. No vocalist has that but Lanza.
Well, you worked as his press representative for a while.
I worked after we did a film called Because You're Mine. Mario's office broke up. His manager, Sam Weiler, left. There was a lawsuit. His PR man, public relations man, Jack Keller, left Mario. It was too much pressure, and he went to work with Jerry Lewis. Now we had no one. So Lanza said to me, Terry, you are my buffer. You are my brother. You live with me. You're handling the press. So I then became, which is not my type of work, I'm in a physical ed business, so I became his PR person. I had to represent the star with the press, set up our interviews and give out notices and call them that he's appearing, so on and so forth.
Well, you've mentioned how the Hollywood studio sent publicity sometimes fake stories about his background, like the fact that he was a GI and a truck driver, which he wasn't. And you've mentioned the way he was misquoted in the press. What were some of the things that you did to try to prevent him from being misinterpreted or misquoted? And did you ever send out things that were a little bit phony also to help give him a good image in the press?
Yes, Terry, we have to create. We all do. I mean, if his name wasn't in a paper for a couple of weeks, we would sit home and think of something. And he'd say, call Hedda, call Luella. And they knew me, so I would call, so they took my call. And if I said it, they knew it was supposedly something that happened. Like he missed hitting the punching bag and he hit me. I walked by. So a tooth was knocked out. Well, they would publish that. A little innocent type thing to keep his name in the paper.
Did that really happen?
No.
Uh-huh.
No, but I mean, we created things like this. It's created all the time. I don't know if you call it a little white lie or whatever it is, but stars have to do that to keep their names alive in a paper. And PR people manufacture such things.
What were some of the other white lies that you
constructed? Well, the worst things, I don't know offhand. You know, the boy has gone 21 years now. But the worst thing that happened to Lanza, he really had to fight the bulge. He really had to fight being fat. Now, his thyroid gland had some problems. He was supposed to take Synthroid, the pill, but he wouldn't take it. But he was very big. He had a 50-inch normal chest. And whenever he ate or gained 10 pounds, it looked like 20, 30 pounds because of his size, of his girth. See, you being tiny, petite, that wouldn't happen to you. But let's say you had a friend who was heavy-boned and wide. Well, if they gained 10 pounds, it would look like 20 pounds, see? So Mario had this problem. Excuse me, I have a little Florida throat. I've been down there for a week. Now, Mario resented when the press would pick on his weight, the tubby tenor, the fat tenor. And he felt, hey, talk about the voice. Don't talk about my weight. Talk about the voice. Let's talk about my art. Let's discuss that. See?
So did you have to distract them?
I had to, yes. I would come in and change stories, whatever. In England, they were brutal to him because he went over there to sing for the Queen, to do concerts. And the first thing they headlined, Tubby Tenor arrives in England. Tubby Tenor. Well, you know, it's a personal thing. He didn't like that. It hurt him. And he'd throw his fits. And sometimes I'd set up interviews and he wouldn't keep them.
Well, you knew a lot about a lot of things that certainly no one would want to ever get into the press. Some of the things you describe in your book, for instance, some of his sexual experiences with women other than his wife, including his vocal coach's wife, kind of bizarre.
That wasn't experience. His vocal coach.
Oh.
That was George London, the bass baritone of the Metropolitan Opera's coach. George London came into California. He was in a bel canto trio with Mario Lanza. In fact, Mario gave George his job. And George went on to be one of the great bass baritones of the Met, to sing and be acclaimed a great hero in Russia. And for a Jewish boy, George was a Jewish boy, actually born in Canada. His name was Bernstein. And that was quite a thing for George. But Mario gave George his job with the bel canto trio. He picked George. And George came to Hollywood, and Mario was really down. I mean, he was hurting. He was having trouble with the studio. And I said to George, let's get him out of the house. He's been sitting in for 4 days. George says, well, I got to go to a coach in Hollywood, he said, and work my voice while I'm here for a week. So I said, let's go with him, Mario. I used to call him Tiger. Let's go, Tiger. So George took us, and I drove the car. And we met this maestro, and we met his wife. The great Lanza was there, so he brought his wife out. Well, while George was singing with the maestro in the back, a music room he had, Mario got up, and I thought he was going to the bathroom. So I sat, but he didn't come back for a while. So I figured I better go look for my friend the Tiger, see? So I walked out, and I went in through a kitchen door, and off in the corner was the maestro's wife who had just met Mario making love. And I closed the door, and I walked back out. Mario came back out, and he sat down, and, you know,
applauded when the song was done.
Yeah.
So you were privy to experiences like this, and you also, during part of his life, served as his press agent. Did it ever get confusing, the stories that you wanted to tell and the stories that, of course, you couldn't tell anybody? You ever worry about the circuits crossing and
sure.
End up telling the wrong
story?
Oh, sure.
A lot of times, Terry, you have to pay off, too. We have, in the book, I have a scene. I wasn't PR man at this time. Jack Keller was. And Mario and I were filming doing the picture to Great Caruso, and I slept with him. We lived at the studio filming that movie. We had an apartment at the studio, see. Big stars in those days had apartments, and while they were in film, while they were working, because they had to be there at 6 in the morning or 6:30 for makeup, and then for costume. So we stayed at the studio those nights. And we had a situation where he and I went out, we saw some rushes at 8 o'clock, and we went to a restaurant and had some Italian food, which was his great love. but the food was never like South Philadelphia here. And we wound up, he wanted a couple of beers. We wound up in a place called The Players on a Sunset Strip. Two fellas and a girl came in. The girl recognized Lanza, and she asked for an autograph. Well, Mario never just signed Mario Lanza. He always wrote, "May I wish you the very best of everything in life, always, Mario Lanza." So it took a little long time to write that. The fella thought they were flirting, and he picked an argument with Lanza. Well, Lanza was raised here in South Philly, and he hit the guy right in the center of his mouth. Well, I had to get him out of there, or there'd be a riot. So I got him out, and the bartender naturally knew us. And finally, I got Mario over to Vic Damone's apartment. Vic had been living in Hollywood making films himself, so that was the nearest place. I brought him to Vic, and I said, "Hide this guy out. Keep him here." I went back to the bar. The bartender told me that the guy lost a tooth. So I said, "Look, I'm going to call Jack Keller right away. Let's keep this out of the paper. We're in the middle of filming. Mr. Mayer will, you know, have a fit." He said, "I'll handle it, Terry. I'll just see how much money the guy wants." It cost $5,000. It was kept out of the paper.
I guess it was certainly worth it to you, though.
Well, it was worth it to us because a lawsuit, but the guy started it. I mean, he came over and he pushed Lanza. However, we're in film, we're making a film, and the studio would be unhappy with it. But like you asked, and this is the way we covered up.
It must be a strange role for you to be in, because you were not only his friend and confidant and physical fitness training coach, but you also were his a protector and conscience and babysitter, too, in a lot of ways.
When you said babysitter, you're very smart, you're clever, you have good insight. Mr. Mayer said Mario Lanza was a baby. Treat him like a baby. Don't ask him to grow up. He'll never grow up. And one of our troubles at the studio was when Mr. Mayer stepped down, a producer came in by the name of Dori Shari, who did not want Lanza to be a baby. He wanted Lanza to be a prototype of Dori Shari, a three-button suit, tie, shirt, shoe shined. No, Lanza would not go for it. Open collar, let me be Freddie Kokoza from South Philadelphia. And there was great hatred between the now head of the studio, Dori Shari, and Mario Lanza.
Is that how he lost his contract?
Well, Mr. Shari had a lot to do with it. Certainly had a lot to do with hurting Mario. And I have a scene in a book where we did not do the student prints, the film. We did the pre-recording. I have a scene in a book where Lanza asked me to take Mary and Tony, his parents, raised right here in South Philadelphia, to meet the heads of the studio. This never happened before in Hollywood. I brought them into Mr. Skank, the head of the studio, representing Lowe's, Dori Shari, Eddie Mannix, and Benny Thor, the four heads, and Joe Pasternak, the producer, all in this office, and his parents, two beautiful Italian people from South Philly, explaining that their son is going through a breakdown. He found out his business manager mishandled funds. His radio show was taken away from him by Mr. Shari, by Metro, because he was under contract to the studio. They were the bosses. You worked for them. The boy was going through a breakdown. His wife was sick. Every time she gave birth to a baby, she laid in bed for 6 months. She took pills and then took alcohol. The whole house was in an uproar. He was suffering, and the studio would not help. Mr. Skank said, "I have children. I know their problems. If he behaves himself, we'll take him back." And I said to Mr. Mannix, who was acting the head of the studio besides Mr. Shari, I said, "Mr. Mannix, the boy needs help. He's going through a breakdown." He said, "Listen, we're running a big business here. We can't think of one person." That's a direct quote. And to me, knowing what the boy was going through, I know what Mr. Mayer would have done. Mr. Mayer would have babied him, would have sent him a rattle to get him back, because he meant that much money to the studio. See, Lanza fought for one thing and got into trouble. He fought for artistic achievement and got into trouble.
Seems like it's a fairly constant problem, or at least watching movies and seeing the movies that are made about Hollywood. Fictional movies about Hollywood would give you the impression that stars are constantly breaking down or having problems with drugs or alcohol or very serious emotional upheavals in their lives. Does that, in fact, in real life happen a lot where actors are just very burdened by personal problems?
I had an opportunity when I was at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. I had the gymnasium there in 1948. They all came to Terry's gym, the boys and girls, actors and actresses. I was on salary by the studio. I had an opportunity then, if I wanted to be an actor, to become an actor. I knew every producer, every director. I was on the sets. But when I watched the people work from early in the morning when they got there at 6:30 a.m. and went into makeup and then wardrobe and then went out on the set and they set up a scene and they had to do it over and over and over. Now, everyone is speaking. Someone goofs a line. Someone doesn't act right. You have to repeat the same thing over and over, sometimes 6 takes, sometime 24 takes. By the end of a day, they're all nervous wrecks. I said to myself, this is not my field. I want no part of it. And I can tell, I mean, 1,000 stories of how these people reacted. They drank, they smoked, they took uppers, they took downers. I mean, if they were dead the next day when they came in, if they stayed out late at night, they had to take something to bubble. This is their life's work. And so it became a vicious cycle. Now, today it's a little different. Today, if you have enough money, you can make your own film and let them distribute it. See, but back in my day, in the late 40s and early 50s, the studio was the boss. They put you on the contract, and hey, you reported.
So you think it's a little better now?
It's a little better for the individual. I mean, you go out, you take your camera, you write and direct like John Cassavetes is doing with his wife. They have a film out right now. John made that himself, wrote it, and directed it. He catered to John and what John wanted to do. See, and I think they're better off doing it that way. I absolutely do.
So it's like less of a service.
Why be a puppet?
Why
be a puppet? Absolutely.
Would you think people are healthier now who are working on films?
I think we know more about our bodies today. I think health is in. I come from a state, California, that's considered the physical culture state. I myself are in a business where I train many stars. I work with George C. Scott and Trish Vandeveer, who are now in New York on a play. I work with Anthony Hopkins, who's got a beautiful movie out now, The Elephant Man. Ricardo Montalban is, Rick, I won't tell his age, but he's still a leading man. He trains 5-6 days a week, works out with weights, swims. So today they do stay in shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's get back to talking about Mary Alonzo. If you're just joining us, my guest is Terry Robinson, who worked with Alonzo for many years. And as he was explaining, he was the physical fitness training coach for a while with MGM. And he's written a book about Mary Alonzo called Alonzo, His Tragic Life. I'd like to talk about one of his famous films to which you alluded a few minutes ago, The Great Caruso. You quote Louis B. Mayer as having said that he was advised by his advisors that it was a stupid film to make because, after all, no one was going to pay money to see a film about an opera star.
They told Mr. Mayer, why opera? Who is going to buy opera? And Mr. Mayer said, Lanza is an opera singer, but he has a hit record out called Be My Love, which is selling in the millions. He definitely will sell to the kids. They'll go to see him. Mr. Mayer was right. We made that picture in 31 days. 31 days of actual shooting, 1 month of pre-recording. Now, on the pre-recording, Mario insisted that people come out from the Met. So they brought Dorothy Kirsten and Blanche Thiebaum. Valdango came out, Giuseppe Valdango, Nicola Mosconi. But something very interesting happened with The Great Caruso that gave Mario the temperamental name at the studio. Mario wanted Dr. Peter Herman Adler to conduct the opera. He was from New York. Now, he was the head of NBC Opera. The studio always have people under contract. They have a music department, an art department, a drama department. Well, all the people in the music department wanted to handle this picture. And when Lanza insisted upon Peter Herman Adler being brought out at another salary, they said, who does Lanza think he is? I'm qualified. They were all qualified. Whether they were or not, Mario didn't want any of them. He wanted Adler, who he felt safe with artistically. Mr. Mayer allowed him, like I say, give the baby his rattle. Mr. Mayer allowed him to have Dr. Peter Herman Adler. Well, the people in the music department behind Mario's back tore him apart because they were slighted. But Mario, feeling, hey, I want the best for this film. I don't want this film to be musically inferior. Now, time tells us Lanza was right. They still play The Great Caruso. In its first year of release, it made close to $40 million in those days. And the kids, Bobby Soxers, went to see it. See?
Well, let's hear a recording from it. This is The Loveliest Night of the Year. And do you want to say something about it?
No, it's The Loveliest Night of the Year is an old tune from Over the Waves. And in the picture, Anne Blythe sang this, but we recorded it. Lanza did not sing this in the picture, but Anne Blythe did, his co-star.
Okay, well, let's hear his recording of it. Here we go.
Touch them from here. Words fall into rhyme any time you are holding me near. When you are in love, it's the loveliest night. Wonderful touch of your hand, and my heart starts to beat like a child when a birthday is near. So kiss me, my sweet, it's the loveliest night of the year.
Mario Lanza singing The Loveliest Night of the Year. My guest is Terry Robinson, who worked with Lanza for many years, both as his physical fitness trainer and his close companion. He's written a biography of him called Lanza, His Tragic Life. And what Robinson currently does is continuing the work he's done for many years, which is working with many actors and actresses, helping them find good physical fitness programs and helping to keep them in shape. Now, during the filming of The Great Caruso, in which this song was sung, you were a stand-in for Lanza. What did that entail for you?
I was never a stand-in before and haven't been a stand-in since. But Mr. Mayer wanted this film to be so good, he wanted no trouble on it. So he said to me, "You're Lanza's stand-in." I said, "Mr. Mayer, what is it? I don't want to be a stand-in." He said, "You're his stand-in. I want you close to him 24 hours a day. Don't you leave him." So I then became Lanza Standin. What it meant was they put a wig on me. Whenever I stood under the X's they marked, and they fixed the lights, and I would take Lanza's stance. The actress would come out, whoever it was, Anne Blythe, they'd stand there. and they'd fix the lights. I'd wear a jacket for the color like Lonza was going to wear, even if it was too big on me. And I had to do this all day, and Lonza got such a kick out of this, me being a stand-in, like an actor, you know, a corny little actor. So we made a joke out of it. I did funny little bits. I tried to do impersonations of him, and I'm not an actor, but it made for a happy time on a picture.
So you just had to stand there.
I just stood in while
they
fixed the lights and adjust things, and they put a little X on the floor. But then he would know what X to go to, and the lights would be adjusted for his coloring.
What did you do to keep yourself amused and occupied while you were doing all the stand-in stuff, which just entails having your body in the right place?
Well, when you mean when I'm off scene, off camera?
Even when you're on camera, because they weren't filming, you just had
no. You stand there until they adjust lights. There's 30, 40 people working. You know, I mean, studios, especially at the big studios that MGM was, they're all up on cakewalks all the way up, and everybody's
trying. You talk to the camera people?
Sometimes you talk, sometimes you don't talk. You stand there like a fool sometimes and just wait for them to adjust, which can take a half hour to an hour.
Who usually does the stand-in part?
They have professional stand-ins. Actors pick, big stars can pick their own people. See, it would be a chore for an actor or an actress who's a star to have to stand in, get made up again, because the lights make you sweat, and then go out and do the part. I mean, they couldn't do it. It would be too. It would take too long to shoot a movie. So they have stand-ins that do that. The gopher, the flunky. You stand there and they adjust lights and they say, then the director looks in his camera and he says, yeah, I think that'll go well. Get the star, get Mario, get so-and-so. Now the stand-in walks out.
So you'd never do that again?
Oh, God, no. That's not my thing.
You had said before that you would have had an opportunity if you wanted to act.
Oh, sure.
Do you ever regret the fact that you didn't take them up on that option?
No, because I've been connected with too many stars and I know their muddled lives, and I wouldn't want that. Happiness, see, success is inside of us as people. Happiness is in us. I want to be happy with Terry, and I don't want to have to be somebody else all day long and not be me. I lost my identity for a while with Lonza and the family, because I was known as Lonza's man, the guy with Lonza. And then when I raised the four children after Mario and his wife died, I still was Lonza. I had to raise the four kids. One was 5, one was 7, one was 9, one was 11. And I raised them till each one was 18. Close to 15 years with the children. So I did lose some of my identity. I mean, I lost the fact that I went to college and got my degree in chiropractic, that I was a health club operator. I had now other duties, duties.
Is that why you waited this long to write the book about
it? No, I waited for one reason, Terry. Mario's parents and I lived together. And after Mario and Betty died, I was the crutch for both parents. Mario Lanza's mother and father did not want me to write the story. They did not want people to know that Mario drank as much as he drank. I would say Mario was, unfortunately, an alcoholic. I can explain it. He had an allergy to alcohol. You may know some people, Terry, that are the most wonderful people in the world, but when they drink, they become another person. That was my poor friend Mario. He should have never had alcohol in his system. His wife, every time she gave birth, every time Betty gave birth, she was sick. She had to get off her feet, and they used to give her pills. Well, each doctor would come in and give her different pills, barbiturates and sleeping pills and pickup pills, and Betty drank, and she had a mixture of both. So we had a terrible household going. We had 4 servants to 6 servants around the house. Now, this becomes a vicious cycle. Now, Mary and Tony, his poor parents that came out from South Philadelphia, knew nothing of this. And as soon as their son got very successful, Mary and Tony didn't know what it was all about. In fact, there was a thing between Mario's wife and Mary, Mario's mother, Mary, who was a very attractive woman. And she was better looking than the wife. And she had a good figure. In fact, Mario used to kid about it. He used to tell people, this is my new Italian actress. And when they'd come on a little bit, he'd say, hey, look out, that's Mom. So there was a thing between the wife and the mother where they, when they moved out from, when they sold their little house here in Mercy Street and moved to California, they moved in with Mario and Betty. 6 months later, they couldn't stay together. Mario said, hey, I'm going to rent the house, move in with Papa, Mom. They need help. So see, I became sort of a crutch for Mario, Betty, for Mary, Tony. It was always get Terry, where's Terry, 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 Terry. And I lost my identity there, but I live with the parents. In fact, I couldn't write this story because the parents wouldn't want this to be known. To them, Mario was still little Freddy Kokoschka of South Philadelphia. Right. He wasn't an angel. He wasn't a saint. He was a man. He had the failings that all we have.
Well, Lonzo, you work with his alcohol problem, and since then you've worked with many actors and actresses
others
who have
too.
Problems themselves.
Yes.
Now, I've spoken on this show to a lot of therapists who work with people with drinking problems. You've worked with many people with drinking problems. What have you found to be successful in diverting someone from alcohol?
The only successful thing that, which is successful only in one way, if they will listen, they themselves have to stop drinking. It's personal. But I found through a good physical workout, that nervous type that needs that workout, I won't mention names of other stars, but I had quite a few of them that needed a good physical workout. I mean a knockout where they were drained at the end and they said, geez, let me relax. Whew, I feel good. Let me relax. I feel good. And they didn't go to the alcohol. They were able to sustain while they were training with me and keep off it. It was when they had nothing to do and they were troubled, where they had no emotional release.
Do you find that anxious people do well when they work out a lot?
Yes, absolutely. It's mental as well as physical. Mm-hmm. See, the brain must have oxygen, and oxygen is through a workout. You get your deep breathing, and if you don't have that oxygen going to the brain, you can get senile.
Well, we're running a little short on time, but I'm wondering a little bit about the film The Student Prince, which I think Lonzo was supposed to be in, but they got someone else to play the role he was supposed to play, but he did the dubbing. And was this one of the first films that had someone other than the star doing the singing?
Well, it was a pitiful thing what happened, but there were other films where they dubbed in voices, singing voices for actors. What happened on this film was there was a song written for The Student Prince called Beloved. And in this song, the Prussian prince tells the girl, tonight is the masquerade, I take my masquerade off, and honey, it's tonight or never. Now, Lonzo sang this song, Beloved, with so much emotion, you can get goose pimples. When he finished it, Curtis Bernhardt, the director, came over, and Mario, all he wanted Curtis to say was how great it was, because the orchestra actually applauded Lonzo. In fact, I went over and I gave him a kiss on the cheek. I said, my God, you made the hair stand up on my arms. The director said to him, Mario, we do another one. Don't do it so emotional. You see, in the picture you are a Prussian prince. So Mario said, oh, really? I'm an Italian. And when an Italian tells a girl he loves her and he's going to take her, and tonight or never, he tells her with emotion, direct my acting, don't direct my singing. And maybe that's why the Prussians never got anywhere as singers or lovers. And he blew his top. He walked out because he wanted the director, Curtis Bernhardt, taken off the picture. And the studio said, no, Bernhardt stays. So we did all the pre-recordings for The Student Prince, and we did not do the film. They hired an English actor named Edmund Purdom. Purdom mouthed in Lonzo's voice, which was very bad, because Purdom being an English-speaking, how could he mouth in a kid from South Philly's voice? Lonzo's album of The Student Prince sold over 2 million copies, which is really something. The picture didn't make it, but the album certainly made it.
Did he always feel badly about that?
Mario felt badly that he didn't do The Student Prince, because I think The Student Prince with Lonzo, I think Lonzo was a student prince. I think he was just a type fitted for it. And he felt he cheated his fans of not appearing on film.
Well, you're visiting Philadelphia today, and here there's a Mario Lonzo Museum, and his hometown is here, South Philadelphia. I don't know how much contact you have with people who live in South Philly, but what do you think his reputation is now in South Philly?
Great. And I have a great rapport here, because I come in every year. This is my 20th year coming in. We have the Mario Lonzo Institute here, Terry, where we give scholarships to kids that need funds in Mario's name. I'm the master of ceremonies. I'll be at Palumbo Sunday night, the 9th, and we've given 84 scholarships. And one of our scholarship winners is now with the Met, Lando Bartolini. And it makes us feel good that we can help these youngsters. And I think the people of South Philadelphia should be commended on the success of this, because we are now worldwide.
Mm-hmm. So you're now most of the time in Southern California.
Oh, I live in, yeah, my home is in California, and, mm-hmm. and that's where the kids are. That's where Colleen, Lisa, Damon, and Mark are, Mario's four children.
OK. Okay, well, listen, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I want to thank you a lot for coming today.
I love this program. I love you. You're sweet.
Oh, thanks. I've been speaking with Terry Robinson, and we've been talking about the subject of his new book, Lanza, His Tragic Life, which is published by Prentice Hall. And as we were discussing, Robinson worked very closely with Lanza, first as his physical fitness training coach, then as a very close friend of the whole extended families. When Lanza and his wife both died, Robinson became the guardian of their four children. And now he still does a lot of physical fitness training and workouts with his health spas in Southern California. We're going to hear one final record with Mario Lanza, and this is another song from the film Be My Love. This is Serenade.
Blossoms on the bough. Nothing is heard but the song of a bird, filling all the air with dreaming. Could I hear this song forever? Stirs the willows. I see your face in the stars that shine above.
Hold me closer tonight, we love.
The willows bending, the stars that shine, the shorelights blending, they're yours and mine. Drifting along in my heart, there's a song, and the song in my heart will not fade. Oh, hear my serenade, my moonlight serenade.
Mario Lanza singing The Serenade from The Student Prince.